The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmn.org. Thank you for listening.
For Master Dogen's Shobo Genzo, Continuous Practice, Part 2. On the gray road of Buddha ancestors, there is always unsurpassable practice, continuous and sustained. It forms the circle of the way and is never cut off. Between aspiration, practice, enlightenment, and nirvana, there's not a moment's gap. Continuous practice is the circle of the way. Teachings speak of Buddha nature, self nature, non-abiding awareness, timeless awareness, vast and boundless, prajnaparamita, all these ways of speaking about an ever-present aspect of reality that is present in everything, that is the nature of everything, that to speak of it in any way, really, in some way diminishes and divides. To be an aspect of reality means that there's something outside of it. To be something that's possessed means that it's an object like, has an object-like quality. None of these are true. To be emptied of any inherent fixed quality, this continuous practice appears in every seeker, in every student, in every moment of awareness. It's something that's present whether we notice it or not. We can never grasp it, but it's the very stuff of practice. Practice is, in a sense, stepping into that stream knowingly. Teachers since the time of the Buddha have spoken of this, particularly within the Mahayana tradition. Longchenpa said, "Ah, listen, great and courageous beings, what is called timeless awareness? Timeless awareness is awareness that is always the case. Naturally occurring timeless awareness is awareness that is always so. As for timeless awareness that cognizes sense objects, that sees, that perceives, that knows, it is not naturally occurring in the sense that it depends on those objects. In the absence of those objects, it's not evident. Therefore, naturally occurring timeless awareness is timeless awareness in the sense that it is awareness that is always the case. It forms the circle of the way and is never cut off. And it's, in a sense, obviously a difficult thing to have faith in. Because our experience of the world, if something was so true, so pervasive, so ever-present, so much the nature of everything, then why would that, and is the manifestation, is the source of everything that appears, then why would so much pain and confusion appear? Siobhan yesterday talked about confusion. And afterwards we had a little follow-up on that confusion. And I asked her, I said, because she talked about being confused and what that's like, and I said, what's even worse than knowing that you're confused? And she said, not knowing. Not knowing that we're confused is the most, in a sense, the most terrible thing of all. It also happens to be the most pervasive thing of all. Because we don't know. If we know we're confused, then we have a shot at taking that in, letting that somehow mediate our actions, if we care about things. If we don't care, then all bets are off. But if we care, then that might, knowing that we're confused, might help us to slow down a little bit. Consider, as the Buddha said, think twice before you speak. Is this what you're going to say necessary? But when we don't know that we're confused, and we're confused, it's a kind of inaccessibility. It's very hard to penetrate that. Because within that state, there is no confusion in the experience. And of course, we've all been there. And so it's very difficult to gain access to that because there's no break, there's no crack, in a sense. And isn't that what we see so much of right now? And so to hear this language, to consider these teachings, and to hear them over and over and over again from every generation, from teachers from all these different countries, cultures, tongues, traditions, even practitioners or deep travelers in other traditions who've had direct contact with some aspect of reality, report the same basic thing. Dogen says, the effect of sustained practice is sometimes not hidden, and therefore you aspire to practice. The effect is sometimes not apparent. Therefore, you may not see or hear or know it. Understand that although it's not revealed, it's not hidden. When the effect of practice is not hidden, then we aspire to practice. That's easy. Although it doesn't always naturally follow. Sometimes when we see the effects of our practice, people will take a little holiday. Literally. Things are good. So take a little break. Sometimes people do that without knowing. Sometimes they do it quite consciously as a kind of, do I really need to keep doing this? Is this really necessary? What inspires us to practice? When you look around, what inspires you to this Dharma? Inspires you towards the Dharma. When I think of growing up and so hungrily looking for inspiration before I even really was aware of it, and so just looking amongst my friends, but they were my peers, so, you know. More I looked towards the adults because I thought some version of that is where I'm headed. And so as I looked to those different examples of what growing up looked like and looking within the families and the friends of my friends who some were quite wealthy and some were quite not. Some had a lot of sort of bounty in their lives, a lot of goodness in their lives, and some didn't. Some of my friends' families had very difficult lives. And not seeing a lot of happiness. Not finding a lot of inspiration. And then unexpectedly in different times, in different moments, coming across people in all different situations that seemed to have something. There was something going on there that got my attention. And I saw that it, because of the mix-up of it all, I saw, well, it doesn't seem to be directly related or necessarily related to wealth or position or status or this or that, because some of the people I saw who were very inspiring to me were people who led difficult lives. In Buddhadharma, we call bodhicitta our aspiration. And so in a sense, when we enter into training, we're given a language, we're given sort of introduced to the notion of aspiration. For many of us, that might be a rather new concept in the way that it needs to be in practice. And then we're guided in what kind of aspiration is worthy of this life. What kind of aspiration does this path, does entering into this circle require? How do we bring that together into alignment? Practice is action. It's what we do. You know, when I was looking when I was in my teen years, you know, and finding lots of, it was the 70s, so there was lots of things going on. Lots of versions of don't worry, be happy, it seemed. And I knew, it's like I already knew, I need to do something. There's something that I am going to need to do. Like, I'm not just going to hear somebody's idea and that's going to change something fundamentally. I just somehow knew that. And so when I encountered the Buddhadharma and meditation, I thought, oh, that's what I do. Of course. So practice is an action, it's an intention, it's a thought. It's our thoughts, it's what we invoke in our mind. It's what we aspire to, it's our actions. And each of those actions has a consequence. And when we practice in accord with the Dharma, those consequences are the mind calms, the body relaxes, emotions begin to soften and become more transparent. Our concentration grows stronger. We begin to understand the primary role of mindfulness and how deep it is. Our reactivity begins to recede. We have moments of direct experience and insight. But how is it when aspiration and evidence of practice is slight or absent, when you don't see the effect of sustained practice? The effect is sometimes not apparent, and therefore you may not see or hear or know, but know that although it's not revealed, it's not hidden. And so that's so important. I talked about that the other day. And why is Dogen saying these things? Because in the 1200s, they needed to know this. His students needed to hear this. And how did he know that? Because he had needed to hear it. And he had heard it from his teachers. And then had practiced and come to realize it's true. It's true what they're saying. And so then he did what has been done generation after generation, as he turned that around. He passed that on. And it's reasonable to want to know that our practice is effective, right? That we're not just practicing blindly. That there isn't a blind faith. There's faith, but not a blind faith. And then the not blind means the faith in a certain level is provisional until it's verified. And then that emboldens us, gives us strength and faith to have more faith. It's really quite a beautiful kind of thing going on. But it doesn't work from the couch. Dogen says, as it is not divided by what is hidden, apparent, existent, or non-existent, you may not notice the causal conditions which led you to be engaged in the practice that actualizes you at this very moment of unknowing. The reason you don't see it is that becoming conscious of it is not anything remarkable. Investigate in detail that it is so, because the causal condition your aspiration is no other than the continuous practice, though continuous practice is not limited by the causal condition. I've spent a lot of time with this paragraph. I think there's a tremendous amount here. This is, I would love to be able to ask Master Dogen just one or two questions. What was he thinking of when he wrote these words? Causal conditions are not hidden. They are already here. It is not divided simply because it's hidden or not hidden, existent or not existent. It's not affected. And so we may not notice the conditions that led us to this very moment. The Buddha said, the depth and breadth and complexity of karma is such that only a perfectly enlightened being can fully understand all of the webs of causation, which means for us, it is always, you know, we only see some of it. And I think this is why, in part, why Dogen is saying this. Because it will never be completely clear to us. We will never completely understand the causal relationship that is always present in every moment and in our every action. And if we're sort of predicating what we do on that, then we will constantly have a kind of conditional practice. And so to study karma, nonetheless, to study it, the inner and outer workings of action and consequence, and that we may not notice it because continuous practice, the nature of reality, is not affected by existing or not existing, by complete or incomplete. It's kind of like, I think of it kind of like being when you're in good health, right? You don't notice your health. We notice our health when we become sick. Then it becomes very present to us. The fact that everything is complete from the beginning, it's hard to notice it until there's an illness, and we call that dukkha. Continuous practice that actualizes itself is no other than your continuous practice right now. You know, to think of all of the, like if you had tried to say, what were the causal conditions of your finding the Buddha Dharma, right? And we could all, you know, grab moments, conversations, encounters, things that happened in our life, but those are just moments, right? Think of all of the many moments, subtle, hidden, passing quickly by, in which there was some shift, some subtle shift, some seed planted, some already planted seed strengthened. And how long that was happening before we began to be aware that something is happening. How long did we live within that, the question or the doubt or the doubt about what the hell is going on until it became clear to us. It didn't just start in that moment. Continuous practice that actualizes itself is no other than your continuous practice right now. The now of this practice is not originally possessed by the self. The now of practice doesn't belong to you. And yet it is wholly undivided from you. The now of this practice doesn't come and go. It doesn't enter and depart. It's not a born thing. It's not a dying thing. That's why, you know, we can, you know, defile the three treasures. We can burn our robes. We can torch all our sutras. I'm out of here. This is bullshit, right? But the Dharma, in a sense, will never forsake you. It doesn't know how to turn its back because it doesn't have one. Which means continuous practice is, in fact, always present. It is always now. And how do you know that? Because after wandering for a year or 100 years, the moment you turn back, you realize, oh, you never left. Practice actualizes itself, completes itself, is sufficient itself, whether we have faith or not. What I was talking about the other day, you know, we can love practice, we can be inspired and practice within that love and inspiration, or we can be upset at practice in the Dharma, we can be angry at it, have a list of complaints about it, and still practice it. And that's a very profound thing. To manifest that kind of faith within the loss of faith, to manifest that kind of love of the Dharma within estrangement from the Dharma, and that it is completely authentic. You're not making anything up. If you're not making anything up. The word now does not exist before continuous practice. The moment when it's actualized is called now. Practice only ever and has only ever happened now. Insight has only ever happened now. Letting go has only ever happened now. This being so, Dogen says, your continuous practice of this day is a seed of all Buddhas and the practice of all Buddhas. That's why it is that all Buddhas are actualized and sustained by your continuous practice. I was thinking of this like our parents, our families, what we do with our lives as the children of our parents confirms and gives life to those who gave us life. When we live, they live. When we awaken, they awaken. When we shift the karma, our karma, we shift the karma that goes back. And in that way, isn't that part of what the gift of this life is we have the opportunity, particularly having come this far, to perhaps do certain things that some of our ancestors were not able to do because they lived at a different time, a different sensibility, a different consciousness, or they were different, a different person. What a wonderful gift. Then Dogen says, even if you might try to ignore this truth in order to hide a crooked intention and escape from it, this ignoring is also continuous practice. And he says this in many different places. Then even if we try and hide or wrangle or deceive or that very action, that in other words, it is inescapable. We cannot escape from ourselves. We cannot escape from our Buddha nature. It is not that kind of thing. Which means that all of our efforts to do that can only and will certainly cause different kinds of conniptions. Because we're flailing against something that does not yield. There's no bargaining. Because it's not an it. And it's not anything other than ourselves. And so, again and again and again, the message, Sean was talking about hints, the hint that we're getting is better now. Better now. I mean, what a wonderful, simple, sometimes very difficult basic principle of practice. Don't put it off. When this Dharma arises in this moment, it's arising because of past causing conditions. This is the moment. I mean, that's a basic Buddhist teaching. Certainly in the Mahayana, the moment that it arises is so that we can free ourselves. And so he says, to go off here and there looking for continuous practice appears similar to the aspiration for it. But it is like leaving behind the treasure at the home of your true parent and wandering poor in another land, wandering through wind and water at the risk of your own life. You should not discard the treasure of your own parent. While you're searching in this way, the Dharma treasure would be missed. This being so, still, continuous practice, because of this, continuous practice should not slacken even for a moment. And it's interesting that Dogen says this, because of course in his time, it wasn't that different than in our time. Right? To go off here and there looking for continuous practice appears similar to the aspiration of it. And so we can appear to be very sincere as we go from one Dharma center to the next, to the next, to the next, from one tradition to the next, to the next, to the next, from lineage to the next, seeking the perfect Sangha, the perfect teacher, the perfect practice, the perfect teaching, and never stop wandering. And of course, the beauty of that is we never have to face it. And we never have to be faced by somebody who continually shows up every time you go in that room. They're still there. Every time you come to the Zendo, they're still here. I remember difficult relationships in my own training early on and realizing I can't get away from you. And it's like, oh, the curse of it and the gift of it. Because it's like, okay, well then, it's pretty obvious what needs to happen. Something needs to happen. Escape is not an option. And now, of course, we have endless ways to go off here and there. And all the while, Dogen says, it's like leaving the treasure at the home of your true parent. And I think the Dogen here must be thinking of the Lotus Sutra, which was a favorite sutra of his. He quotes it often. And in that, as many of you will remember, there's the story of the wandering child. And so in the Lotus Sutra, there's a story of a young person who leaves their father. And in this case, it is the father who's also a very wealthy, powerful person, a king, and is Buddha, is your self nature, is your parent holding the treasure, the place of your birth, the source of your life. And this child goes wandering, abandoning their father, runs away and lives for a long time in other lands, wandering and wandering and wandering from here to there, 10 years, 20 years, 50 years. And as they keep wandering, they're getting older. And as they're getting older, they're getting poorer and poorer and more destitute and more desperate. Things are closing in. And so they move faster and faster, looking for clothes, food, anything to try and take it away. And then this line where it says, until by chance the child turns their steps in the direction of their homeland. What a pregnant line. Until by chance, years and years of wandering, until by chance. Is it? Is it just left up to chance? Is it we just one big poker game? Roulette table? Or do you have something to do with it? Does every step, all of those years of wandering and wandering, in fact, brought this child, this person, this incipient Buddha, to that very place where It appears by chance. Why? Because they don't notice the conditions. They don't yet see what is actually going on. They don't understand the river they're swimming in. And so it seems that by chance, they just happen to turn in the direction of their homeland, and they don't even know it yet. Meanwhile, the father has been thinking about their child every day, every day. How are they? Where are they? Are they okay? Don't they understand that they have all of this wealth available to them that I want to give to them? And so although the child may have rarely thought about the father thinks about the child every day. Of great concern. And so there's a time where the impoverished child wanders in from village to village and then comes to the city where their father resides. And the father, meanwhile, is sitting on a throne surrounded by jewels and servants and fans and wealth and power. All of the abundance. And all the while thinking, if I could only find my child and trust this wealth to them, give them this wealth, then I could be at ease. Then I would feel contented. I wouldn't have to worry anymore. And so when the child sees the father, and looks over and sees the father, they're frightened because they see this very powerful person. And they think, oh, I can't go any closer. It's sort of like when Moses was going up Mount Sinai to get the Ten Commandments. And the Israelites were gathering around, and God said to Moses, don't let them look at me. They cannot look at me. If they do, they'll die. That's why the Buddha said, if we can face the truth and not cower, not run away in fear, then perhaps we're ready. And so the father sees the child and is delighted. Of course, the child doesn't recognize the father. Doesn't recognize the father. Doesn't recognize self-nature. But the father completely knows the child. And so he sends out some servants to bring the child in so they can talk and he can bestow all this wealth. And the child freaks out. He says, what are you doing? What are you doing? I haven't done anything wrong. Why are you doing this to me? Any of you have that thought this week? I've often thought one of the reasons for entering into training through the Guardian Council and Tongariyo and all the questions and clarification is so that at that moment, when the student says, why are you doing this to me? We can say, you did this. You did this. But this child is not there yet. So they freak out and they faint. And so the father realizes, oh, they're not ready. Not ready. So calls their servants back and says, leave them alone. Leave them alone. And so then he has to become skillful. He realizes the direct approach is not going to work. Right? Because the child does not recognize me. Will not believe. Will not believe that they are, that all of this belongs to them. And so the father has to become skillful. So he sends the servants back and says, look, tell my child that I want to offer them a job. And if they ask what the job is, tell them that it's shoveling shit in the stable. And so they do that. And the child says, okay, I'm good with that. I can do that. Because the father realized that the child sees themselves in a very diminished place, right? Not worthy of that wealth. And then it's interesting in the sutra it says So the child says, okay, I'll do it. I'll come work for this great king. And says, at that time, the impoverished child asked for an advance on their wages. Interesting. What's that about? Wanting proof? Wanting a little guarantee before they step in? Or is it being smart? Right? And so goes to work in the stable, shoveling shit. And now and then the father will dress up in really ragged clothes, slap mud on his face, and go down and work with the child, just to get close, just to be close. And says, you know, you're a pretty good worker. I've watched you. You're pretty good. You're not deceitful. You're not lazy. You don't get angry. You don't talk about other people behind their back. From now on, I'm going to treat you like my own child. It says, at that time, the impoverished child, though they were delighted at such treatment, still thought of themselves as a person of humble station who was in the employ of another, still thinks that they're working for somebody else, still thinks that they are 100 miles away, don't yet see the relation, don't yet see the family resemblance. Don't yet notice. You know, I'm going to talk about this tomorrow, but you know, the kleshas are just fascinatingly and maddeningly, is that even a word? Mm-hmm. Complex. And they're also very simple. You know, their message is always very simple. You're the best. You suck. It's usually not a complicated message. And how we can hold so much of the whole spectrum and vacillate, right? That's the encore and the rotten app, rotten tomatoes. And for years and years and years, I don't know how many years, I stopped counting, reliably, predictably, even though I tried not to anticipate it or expect it, there would be one day in session when I was convinced that I was that child, that I should be out there shoveling shit. What the hell am I doing in this hall? What the hell am I doing wasting my teacher's time? And it was so convincing. And as years went on, it became more and more irrational, right? Because it would even get to the point where I would think, you know, I'm waiting for the monitor to say, Dada Roshi wants to talk to you. And he's like giving me my notice, right? We tried, we all tried, you know. We stuck with it for a long time. You can't say we didn't try, but, you know, it's just not working. And even as I knew, it's like, okay, this is not real. And I could see where does this come from? It still had power. And so even as we're seeing the affirmations, the confirmations, as Dogen said, the circle of the way confirms you. And our lives confirm. I do remember once when I thought, maybe those doubts are true, because I went into Doksan at a particularly low moment. And this is, you know, I've been here quite a while. And I went and I said, it's just not working. I don't feel like I've made any progress. And I'm just like muddleheaded. And it's like, you know, nothing's happened. And he's like, yeah, well. I swear, he didn't put up a fight at all. And it was like, that's not what I was expecting. And then I remember it was a very short doksan. He was like, he just sent me away. And I thought, damn it, that's not true. And I wanted to go in and argue with
him?
So after some time passed, the father realized he was going to die. And he thought, you know, I need to bequeath this. My child needs to inherit. And so finally, after the child had stepped in more and more into that circle, had realized more and more that they were in the circle, were taking on the responsibilities of a Buddha, of a Bodhisattva, were living the life of, the father realized, okay, they're ready. And so he called everybody together, all the elders of the community, and said, this is my son, this is my child. They were born on such and such a date. This was their name. They went wandering off. And I bequeath all of this to my child. And it says, when the impoverished child heard the words of their father, they were filled with great joy, having gained what they had never had before, and thought to themselves, I originally had no mind to covet or seek such things. Yet now these stores of treasures have come of their own accord. After all of those years of shoveling manure and step by step by step, working hard, diligently, being true, being faithful, being conscientious, finally, at that moment, they realize it wasn't really of my own doing. Wandering through wind and water at the risk of your life, please don't discard the treasure of your own inheritance. If you search in that way, the Dharma treasure, which is always present, will be as though absent. And so, this being true, continuous practice should not slacken even for a moment. And so forsake name and gain in this lifetime. Practice one thing thoroughly. This is the vast continuous practice of the Buddha's timeless life. Practice one thing thoroughly now. Just make that a mantra. Practice one thing thoroughly now. 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 Love and respect your body, your mind, and the self that's engaged in this continuous practice. And the self, he means the whole of it. He means the self that is you, that it has your name, your history, your personality, that keeps you on that cushion, that brings you back again, that remembers to be mindful, that returns to the precepts when they need to be returned to, right? That relaxes when you're too taut and strengthens when you're too loose, that self. To appreciate, to love and respect that aspect of self. The self is empty. That's its fundamental nature. And it appears within our consciousness. That's an aspect of our consciousness. And so we have all of this language, right, that is referring to this sense of someone. Because everyone has that sense. That does not have to be extinguished. It is not a thing. It's just a sense of something. And so more the question is, how, when that sense of self arises, or when it arises, is it helpful to you now in the form that it's arising? When it's self-disparaging, self-critical, self-loathing, self-doubting, that sense of self is not helpful. When you meet that with a sense of self that is compassionate, that has loving kindness, that sense of self is helpful. And in that moment, that doubting sense of self becomes helpful because it is the way by which we gain confidence. It is the way by which we ultimately see through into its emptiness, that it actually is not you, is not me. And so to love and respect this body, this mind, and self, because otherwise we cannot be here, we cannot practice. So again, I'll end, let Dogen end with a poem of his. Treading alone in this dreamlike illusory realm, without looking for the traces I may have left, a cuckoo's song beckons me to return home. Hearing this, I tilt my head to see, who has told me to turn back? But do not ask me where I'm going as I travel in this limitless world, where every step I take is my home. Who is it that's calling you back? Don't ask where you're going as you travel, because every step you already arrived. The circle that is unbroken. And so to practice that is to do just that all the way through. So be aware of the mind that begins to look for, to step out of this circle, which is just now, and step into a future, not real world, which sounds like tomorrow or next week, and realize that's wandering away from home, from my place of wealth, of treasure. It is not now. And anything apart from now appears as lacking. And so in that way, to practice this timeless, continuous circle of the way means to keep forgetting about time. You don't need to track it. You don't even need to know what day it is. We'll let you know. Rest assured. And then that frees us to be holy in this one complete moment that includes everything.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about our ongoing programs and residency opportunities, visit zmm.org.